likely not meet on a single track and have a collision. And I forgot what it was, but yeah, there was no paper tape at the time. It was all, hand copied. And the telegraph was, in effect, the first party line. Any station on that circuit would receive messages for anybody. Each station had a two-letter code. For example, Spionk would be SK. And if Hicksville needed to send a message to Spionk, he would pound out the letters for Spionk, and then the two-digit code from Hicksville. It would be similar to us calling a station on the radio, but it would be SP, and I don't know what they use for from. He probably just said the word from, and HK. Then he would close his key. Spionk would answer, and, then Hicksville would send their message.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Morse code. It's got such a rich history to it. I thought we'd dig a little bit deeper into this one. KCWGB, K2LIW and TechNet. Go right ahead, John.
And here we go, Dick. November 2, let's go ask you with a comment.
Very good, Dick. Herb Ritchie in there. Okay, Rob, thank you for that information. Good stuff. Also, Dick, remember, on the sounder, the spring adjustment was basically to adjust for the voltage differential from station to station, and the spring on the key was for the operator's selective pressure. Why don't you pick up, Rich, and we'll go on to the next. KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. Go ahead with your comment, Rich. N2EO, K2RW, and check that.
Okay, Dick, just wanted to comment. I used to have a friend who passed away, Danny, KU2D. His original call was WA2HR1. And as he saw this, Danny was in excess of 60 words a minute. In fact, he went one year to Dayton Hamvention. He had a code run, like a code contest. And he was beaten out only by a guy who they called Blazing Paddles from the West Coast. Danny came in number two. Danny was in excess of 60 words a minute. Danny passed away about 10 years ago. He had a lot of problems, and pneumonia finally did him in. But Danny used to stutter very bad, so he worked strictly CW. And he would act, it was amazing. He'd be on the telephone with me, and at the same time, topping high-speed CW. And for myself, I was only up to like 18 to 22 words a minute. So I could find that interesting, Dick, M2EO.
Now, what you're telling us, Rich, is another example of my theory that there's a completely separate section of the brain devoted to Morse code reception. Obvious by what you just described with Danny. Also, I have seen a few of these people who will hold a conversation at the same time that they're listening to Morse code, and in some cases, writing down the Morse code while talking to you on a different subject. How in the world can a person do all these simultaneous functions? I don't know. I mean, all the experts believe that the real processing center of a human brain is a one-track mind. You only do one thing at a time, and when you think appear to be doing multiple things, they think you're doing time sharing. I'm not so sure. You watch one of these really super high-speed CW guys in operation while you're having a conversation with them. There really seems to be two personalities there, I think. In the Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the Morse code expert for a lot of years was George Flanagan, W2KRM, Whiskey 2, Kilowatt Radio Mike. George could send Morse code at any speed you like, probably up to at least 40, 45 words a minute, and it sounded like a machine was doing it. There was no personality. As you get deep into Morse code, you'll realize that every one of us has got a particular characteristic swing, as they call it. Fist is another word they use for it. In other words, once you're doing a lot of Morse code, talking to a lot of your friends on ham radio, for instance, let me drop... What many guys have recognized is that you hear the first couple of letters being sent from somebody, and you say immediately, oh, that's Frank. I recognize him right away. Now, maybe it's the particular characteristic of his transmitter. Maybe it's got a little bit of key click. Maybe it's got a little bit of hum in the background. That's part of it. But in many cases, you can take a guy who you know very well, put him on a code practice oscillator where there is no individual characteristic of the transmitter, and still 90-some-odd percent of the time, you'll recognize the fist of that particular guy. We've all got a certain signature in the way we send Morse code. And so, with practice, you recognize your friends right away. Who would ever believe that? There's a lot more to that story than the first meets the eye. KC2WGB, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Oh, very good. In fact, Johnny Cash, the Western singer there, country western singer, he did over 60 words a minute in the Air Force. So, yeah, there's a lot to be said about that. Let me let it drop and go on to the next question for you, Dick. Okay. Got a young scientist here with a question. That's a good one. All right. He has two mirrors. The mirrors are facing each other. He has a hole in the center of one mirror, and in the rear of that mirror, he places a laser. When he pulses the laser, of course, the light travels from one through that hole to the second mirror and bounces back to the first mirror. When he turns off the laser, it stops instantly. Can you tell him why? That's sort of a good question. KC2WGB.
Yeah, yes, it is, John. Stand by a minute while I address something here. By common sense, you would believe that the light's going to bounce back and forth between the mirrors for a very long period of time. Not true. At 300 million meters per second, which is something like 640,000 miles an hour, the speed of light, it happens real fast. Light moves at roughly 1 nanosecond per foot. In other words, if between two detecting devices you have 1 foot of distance and you carefully detect the leading edge of a beam of light coming past the first detector and passing by the second detector, if the two detectors are 1 foot apart, one detector will be excited 1 nanosecond sooner than the other. That is the speed of light, 1 nanosecond per foot. And so if I had my two mirrors 1 foot apart and I transmit a brief pulse of light between the two, one single bounce is going to be a nanosecond. After the light has bounced off a mirror, you may think your mirror is really flat and perfect and very high in reflectivity. Well, most mirrors that you and I can touch have about 95% reflection efficiency. You're losing 5% of the light on each individual bounce. Let me drop. So after about 100 bounces, 99.9% of the light is gone if you're losing 5% on each bounce. I'm rounding off the mathematics, but you can see what's going on here. If it took 99 bounces for the light to be essentially gone, and the two mirrors are a foot apart, 99 bounces would be 99 nanoseconds. That's approximately 0.1 microsecond. No human brain can see something of that fast. You can easily sense an echo if it's a fraction of a second, something like a tenth of a second. You can easily hear the difference of an echo. And by flashing with your eye, I think you could see things that are a 60th of a second apart. When you flash individual frames of a movie film onto a screen, and there may really be 16 frames per second, but you flash each frame twice, 32 frames per second. So it's what, a 30th of a second for each frame of a flash onto the movie screen. Pretty soon the human eye no longer sees the individual pulses of light. You blur it all together, if you know what I mean. The fastest operating detecting apparatus inside of a human being is the human eye. And so a 30th of a second is the threshold where a human eye can just barely see something occurred and something didn't occur, if you know what I mean. So I think that's the answer he's looking for, but maybe not. Maybe you have to play it one more time, but that light's going to disappear real fast by once you turn off your laser pointer. By human standards, that light is gone in nanoseconds, and your human brain can only detect things in milliseconds, and there's a million-to-one ratio between the speed of the two. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I can remember leave longer pauses for these stations that are out of the area. Very good, Dick. Yeah, that sort of describes it for him. I'm sure he's got a better understanding. I wonder if Glenn, QIQ, is on board. I have a question which we've covered before, according to Glenn, and I've received two questions in the past 2 weeks on the same subject. KC2QIQ, are you on board?
I hope Glenn is listening. Let's give another call for Glenn. KC2QIQ, we need you. Go right ahead, Glenn. K2LIW in the TechNet. Now, Glenn may be listening on his handy talkie. Maybe he's strolling over to the rig. Maybe you should go with the question that was addressable to Glenn. You and I can stumble through it, John. We'll make some mistakes. Glenn will hear us making the mistakes, and that'll allow him to blaze a trail to his rig in which he'll correct our mistakes. I've seen people do that. You intentionally make a mistake in order to bring somebody to the microphone. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
Obviously, he's hiding it. Okay, this is a question we had broached before. I think it was 2 or 3 months. ago on an LED diode, how it emits light, what causes it. Now, Glenn and I had a conversation. He had a great description of what was going on, and he said we covered it on the TechNet. I remember asking the question, but I think when he covered it, it was when we were having a conversation outside of the TechNet. But anyway, he wants to know, when the voltage is applied to the LED, what actually happens in the LED to cause it to transmit that light? That was his question. And these two guys are asking basically the same question again.
Yeah, I'm pretty light on this one. I used to believe that a light-emitting diode was running in the reverse polarity mode like a Zener diode. I'm pretty sure I'm wrong on that on most light-emitting diodes. I believe they're forward biased. In other words, if you measured a light-emitting diode's property as a rectifier, you find out that when you're using it in the light-generating mode, you are forward biasing it. You're putting it in the you're putting the polarity of voltage on it where a small amount of voltage drop is required in order to get conduction. So while the diode is forward biased, those electrons are jumping in between the holes in that semiconductor material, and by some fancy means by which there are two mirrored surfaces inside with that diode, somehow light is generated, and the spacing between the two mirrors becomes a kind of a tuned cavity. And by way of an email I mailed you, at least when it comes to the RF equivalent of a tuned resonator cavity, you'll get a little bit of an idea as to how it works. So by way of the spacing between the two mirrored surfaces in there, light is emitted, and emitted at a very specific wavelength. I have a lot of fun with that laser pointer of mine, particularly when I put it at the eyepiece of my telescope, while the telescope is aimed at a particular terrestrial target. For instance, a speed limit sign on the road, which is made with a beaded screen, and has very high reflectivity. Let me drop. So light-emitting diodes are becoming very dominant in our world. They are by far the highest efficiency light-emitting things that we know of. And although we're more and more outlawing the incandescent bulbs, the ordinary 100-watt filament-type bulb, they're being slowly outlawed. And so compact fluorescent lights are the intermediate thing that we're using. And pretty soon we're all going to be using light-emitting diodes because it saves a lot of electrical power. And they come in various colors and the color temperatures and whatever, light-emitting diodes. So I think 10 years from now, I suspect 90-some-odd% of our homes are going to be lit with light-emitting diode arrays. That's a prediction that I think I've read somewhere, and maybe the number's going to be even higher than that. So anyone on frequency who has any understanding of the physics inside of a light-emitting diode, how does the current that you put through a light-emitting diode, I believe it's forward biased, how does that cause it to generate very specific wavelength of light? What's going on there? Anybody got any further info on this? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Good comment. And to the on that.
K2QIW.
Okay, I heard KC2QIW. And we're going to go over to you right after Rich. N2EO. Go right ahead first, Rich.
Okay, exactly how it creates the light, I don't know, but...
He's not going to be able to make it, Dick.
A couple of years old. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we weren't able to get that, Rich. KC2QIW looks like it was the call of somebody named William Dahl, who now has a new call, W2ANQ. So I'm a little bit confused by that. KC2QIW. K2RIW. Go ahead, William, if that's you.
No, negative. This is Joe from Harrison. I want to do a late check-in. Call sign is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey from Harrison, New York. Name is Joe, and...
made the mistake. I heard it as QIW, and I should have realized you checked in quite a few times before QYW. So, okay, we got you as a late check-in, Joe, and right after we finish with the mailbag, we'll try to pick you up before we go over to the SpaceNet. John, KC2WG, looks like we might not have a person on frequency with enough smarts on how a vitamin diode does this thing. We'll be finding that out sometime in the future as I see it. I'm not pretty sure you'll be able to talk over this guy, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. Very good. To paraphrase what Glenn had said, he had a beautiful explanation for it. It has to do with...
but this spacecraft is going to do two orbits around the Earth. It's going to get out to 3,000-4,000 miles. And by doing that, when it comes back, it will have it at that high speed. And it'll be able to check everything out, the heat shield, the panels that cover the front of the spacecraft have to come off and before the parachutes actually pop off. They'll check everything, and they know it all works good on paper, and I guess nowadays on computer, but they want to see how it does in the real world. It'll be launched on a Delta IV Heavy. If you ever seen one of these things take off, you Google that, bring it up on YouTube, and take a look at the Delta IV Heavy. It's quite an impressive rocket. I think the last one that was launched was in California, in Vandenberg. But they're going to put the Orion spacecraft on top of it. It's a big rocket. And it's like taking three Delta rockets and bolting them together. It's quite an impressive flight. It'll be done from Cape Canaveral. Looking forward to that. Almost 9 months from now. A couple of other things. This isn't really politics, but they want to, or in fact they have renamed the Dryden Center in California for Neil Armstrong. So they actually changed the name. They're going to call it the Neil Armstrong Flight Research Center. They're leaving the name Dryden up. They're going to call the surrounding area, you know, the Dryden Test Range. So in doing that, there's a couple of people that would like to, if they could do that, why can't we change a couple of the other names? They want to change names out in California to the Sally Ride Research Center. You know, they want to see if they could change that name. Why not? They've done it to everything else. Ride, of course, is the first American woman to be launched into space. And, in fact, she just passed away last year. But they would like to do that. And actually, that was the end of 2012 when she died. But I'd like to see something done along those lines. And in fact, that would be the first time I think they name any of the many places for a woman. So that would be pretty good for them. Another topic is the Rosetta. We've talked about this before, but I just want to bring it up again because they're going to wake it up this week. On the 20th, which is tomorrow, they plan on, it actually will wake up by itself. It's got a clock. It's been in deep sleep for a couple of years now. This thing was launched back in 2004, stayed away for many years. They passed the Earth one time, you know, went around the Sun and then passed the Earth again and got a gravity assist, and they went past Mars, and they got a gravity assist from there, came back toward Earth, and another gravity assist each time, increasing the speed, and that pushed them all the way out to on their way right now, about to cross the Jupiter area where Jupiter goes around. And that's where they're going to catch up to that comet. The goal is to catch up to 67P. I'm not going to of the two guys that ain't, that that it's named for, but it's 67B, a couple of long names. But this thing is going to catch up to it and stay with it. They're going to have a land to go down, Philippe, and it's going to actually land on the comet, and that's going to stay there throughout the whole ride as it comes in toward the Sun. Both spacecraft will be with the comet as it goes around the Sun and comes back away, you know, back after it passes the Sun. It goes back out all the way to the past the Jupiter orbit. This comet, it's not one of these Oort cloud comets, you know, coming from, you know, it's been on a million mile in orbit around the sun and past Jupiter, and then it goes back again, so it's not one of these long-term comets. But a comet it is. Eventually we'll have a tail, and it'll check, you know, they got 25 different instruments on board this thing. And they plan on looking into everything that's involved, including NASA has three instruments that they built, including the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They put one of the instruments on board. And so they have an interest in this. Rosetta was launched by the European Space Agency back in 2004 from French Guiana on Ariane 5 rocket. That's their biggest rocket that they use. It should be interesting. A lot of information regarding the all the different pieces of equipment that they use for testing. I don't think I want to get into that. It's way too much. But 25 different pieces of equipment. You know, they have some on the orbiter and some on the lander. And it's quite involved. And they're going to know more about this comet than probably about the Earth. And there's one other launch that's coming up. And that'll be for the year. I believe it's this week. The 23rd is coming up. Today's 19th. So yeah, the 23rd, they have a tracking data relay satellite launch. This is one of the many. This will be the 12th TDRS launch of a satellite. Kind of made it into orbit. This is all for the TDRS, the tracking data relay satellite system. That's TDRSS. Satellite itself, TDRSL, they call them by the letter before they're launched, and once they get into orbit, they'll change the letter to a number. Let me drive it. There's eight still operating, three have failed over the years. Out of the eight, they're all not operating at the same time. Some are used as backups. And the cost is, it's not killing the NASA budget, because it was years ago, decades ago when this all started. It was conceived back in 1973, the first one went up was the year, in the early 1980s. One of them, actually the second one that was scheduled to be put into orbit was part of the payload of the Challenger disaster, so... After that, they decided not to do that anymore. They decided not to put any more Centaur booster rockets in the cargo bay of the shuttles. Because that's what you need. You need a booster rocket to get this thing to the 23,000-mile distance from the Earth to put these things in geosynchronous orbits. So this is the third generation. They had seven TDRSs on the, for the first generation, and they had a second generation, and then this is the second one of this group. I believe there's two or three more coming down the line. They used to be built by TRW, first group. The second group was built by Hughes, and eventually got involved with Grumman. And now this group is being all built by Boeing, so they're more updated, carry more bandwidth, and S-band, K-band, KU-band. Cost is really borne out by the military now. So, the primary purpose, the original purpose, was for teachers to keep astronauts in touch with the ground 24 hours a day. That's what they want to do 100% of the time and achieve that. But all the other satellites, a lot of science satellites use it, including the Hubble Space Telescope, big user of the TDRS system. It turns out the biggest user out of the whole group is the military. Cross systems and, other military satellites that are all on board. So, the budget kind of comes out of the military and the National Security Agency. I'm sure they're never putting these huge bills, $500 million price tags. So at least that's not coming out of the budgets of NASA, which is, I think they're down to around $17 billion or something. So, not hurting them as much. That's pretty much it, Dick, for the space report. For the TechNet, this is WS2N. Any questions? SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. I can be reached. Back to you, Dick.
The teacher satellite tracking data relay. Excuse me a minute. Tracking data relay satellite system. I'm amazed how many of those you said are in operation versus not in operation. And those things did a real good job of eliminating the name, the requirement for downrange tracker. In the case of the Mercury program and Gemini program, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, among very many other companies, were involved in the downrange trackers. You would literally station a bunch of tankers with fancy antennas on board, parabolic dish antennas, with aimable systems at various places around the world so that you can communicate with the spacecraft while it's in orbit, while it's over great big chunks of water where there's no ground station to talk to it. And so it was real troublesome. You always had great big gaps in time in which you couldn't talk to your astronaut. All of a sudden you put up a synchronous orbit satellite 22,300 miles high, looking down in the Earth where it can see more than one-third of the Earth all at once. Therefore, you put three of them together at every 120 degrees around the equator. And now you can talk directly to your satellite, talk directly to your astronauts continuously. So those things really saved an awful lot of effort and increased the safety of the system by a whole lot. So run that by one more time, Paul. How many Tegra satellites are... have been launched, how many are still operational, and I think you're saying a brand new one is about to be launched. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The Tejas L is going to go up, Tejas Lemur. Last year at this time, last January, Tejas K went up. That was the first of the third generation, now being built by Boeing. And it's as an M and an N plan, you know, they plan on launching more. They do have a 15-year life cycle, so they don't last forever. And there are eight that are operating now that they can use. They're all not operating. Some are on standby in case one fails. Needless to say, the military really wants backup. They all want backup, but they really want backup. So you got that. What was I going to say about teachers? Something important I had in mind. Drop it. That's not good. Okay, Dick. Don't come to me. But you've got quite a few of these things. Up in orbit, and two or three more planned to go, and they're now being launched by the Atlas rockets, the Atlas V, the big ones. So, there you go. I know there's something else I was going to say, and that's out of my head right now.
Don't worry, Paul, you're getting over that sound very well. Stand by a minute. Wanted to make sure that... properly reset. One of the other things you mentioned is that the Dryden Flight Test Center, which is literally in the middle of Edwards Air Force Base, right above Lancaster, California. Lancaster and Palmdale are the two major cities nearby. I think the actual town that's closest is Rosemont, if I remember correctly, or at least Rosemont Avenue is the main avenue that goes right down the center of Edwards Air Force Base, but the NASA Dryden Test Flight Center was in the center southern area of Edwards Air Force Base. I used to visit them every time I was out there because they've got a visitor center where you can buy various manuals, maps, and all kinds of memorabilia with reference to NASA. Very nice setup. So Edwards Air Force Base, I understand correctly, is about to become Armstrong Air Force Base. Neil Armstrong Air Force Base. It became Edwards because of a Colonel Edwards that lost his life way back in the late 40s, I think it was, flying a Northrop Flying Wing airplane. And so that's how it became Edwards. When you look at the memorabilia in the main, let's see now, what would you call it now? The cafeteria. I'm going to call it the cafeteria, but they got a fancier name for it, where all the Air Force people go to eat. In the hall there, they've got a closed case where you can look at the history of Edwards Air Force Base. The chunk of land used to be owned by the Corum brothers. C-O-R-U-M was their last name. They reversed that name, C-O-R-U-M, backwards is Muroc. So for quite a number of years in the beginning, it was called Muroc Air Base. Then because of the honor of Colonel Edwards and the Northrop Flying Wing passing away, it became Edwards Air Force Base. And here we are about 30 or 40 years later, it's about to become Armstrong, in honor of Neil Armstrong. Well done, as I see it. And when it comes to Ames Research Center becoming Sally Ride Research Center, that makes some sense. So I wonder if you ever heard of any of that crazy history of Edwards Air Force Base. Corum, Muroc, Edwards, and now Armstrong, in that order. Right alongside of the Antelope Highway, Route 14, that goes between Edwards, and if you take it north, you end up at China Lake. The Navy Research Center and a great big air testing field. I spent some of my life out there way back 15, 20 years ago. And when you're in that section of California, which really is part of the Mojave Desert, you're in the center of the Mojave Desert. And the main thing you notice is that nothing there is green. You spend some life there and you come back to Long Island, you say, boy, do I miss green. Green plants. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
This what? No, the original seven were sat there, you know, Shepard and Sherrar and Grissom and Glenn, Carpenter, a whole bunch. That's when they were flying out there. And then soon after that, I guess they changed it to Edwards. But this is driving. You know the area better than me. I mean, they're actually, it's the UL Dryden, it's research center. They're changing that to the NASA Neil A. Armstrong Flight Research Center. They're going to keep the surrounding area around it. They're going to still call it the UL Dryden Aeronautical Test Center, or Test Range, something like that. So they're going to keep his name active. They're just going to call the center itself the Neil A. Armstrong Flight Center. So they didn't say Edwards. You've been out there, Dick. I've passed there, but never stopped, so you might know that a little bit better. Let me drop in.
Yeah, let me correct that one. Stand by. You're absolutely right. The Dryden Flight Test Center, a division of NASA, is in the middle of what's called Edwards Air Force Base by my standards. And Dryden is named for the Dryden Lake Bed, Dryden Dry Lake Bed. When you enter the Edwards Air Force Base from the west, and I think you're coming from the town of Rosamond, you see a sign saying you're entering a government territory. And you then are on this four-lane highway, two lanes to the east, two lanes to the west, for 14 solid miles before you come to the guard shack. And it's the flattest piece of land you've ever seen, a dry lake bed. Literally, once or twice a year when it rains just right, it becomes the whole area becomes a very thin lake, you know, one-inch thick lake, so to speak. And the land is the flattest thing you've ever seen. There's a mountain range to the north and to the south, but you're on this extremely flat piece of grayish, tan, very dry soil that sometimes people will go off the road and drive onto it. Sometimes they fly the model airplanes there. So when you get into the actual Air Force Base itself, there is this carved-out section that is the NASA Dryden Center in the middle of Edwards Air Force Base. So I guess it's only Dryden that's going to be renamed Armstrong, and the rest of Edwards Air Force Base which is another 85% of the land, so to speak, I guess it's going to probably stay as Edwards. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the Tech Nash.
US2N, yeah, that's the way I read it. So, yeah, I agree. That sounds right. And I thought about what I was talking about before with the Tejas. Remember, they used to have Tejas East and Tejas West. That's when they had two up there. And then they had a third one for a backup. That was the early days of the space shuttle system. And that was interesting. And you got to remember, they thought about this in 1973. That's when the boat came out. But they didn't launch the first one until a little before Challenger. But they, you know, used to listen to the missions, and as they were talking, they said, we're picking you up on Tejas East. We'll be with you for, you know, a half hour and 30 minutes, and then you'll go over to Tejas West or whatever it was, you know. And then there was always that dark spot, you know, over the Indian Ocean, you know. They had nothing. And you wouldn't hear for like 10, 15 minutes. I don't know if you remember all that, Dick, but I used to follow that. But yeah, they had two, and then one is a backup. Now they got eight, and out of eight, probably five or four, maybe three is a backup. I don't know. Back in
you're absolutely right, Paul. When I used to listen to my NASA Select on my television receive-only terminal, my 10-foot dish mounted at the 60-foot level of my tower, I would hear this this exclusion zone around the Indian Ocean normally, where for some number of minutes, as they went from the vicinity of the coverage of one Tejas satellite over to the next, and there was a gap in between where you couldn't talk to your astronauts on the space shuttle during that period of time. I do remember that very well. And as they added more Tejas satellites, that problem went away. Let me pick up Joe right now. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Then I'm going to give you guys a little bit of... Well, then we're going to go over to John in that order to discuss cavity satellites. And then I'll tell you guys what I discovered with reference to Voyager. Is it Voyager? Pioneer and Voyager. I keep confusing them. Yeah, Voyager. Voyager 1. My goodness, is that thing down the road a piece. So, Joe, go right ahead with your question. KC2. Quebec Yankee Whiskey, K2RIW in the Tech Nash.
Roger that. Here, and it slipped my mind. When will they do the, I guess it's called the swap and shop thing? Like, because I'm putting one of my antenna tuners up for sale.
Yeah, very fine, Joe. Swap and Shop is always on Monday night after the InfoNet. So the way Limarc, you can go to Limarc, LIMARC.org, and you can read their schedule. Monday night starting at 8:30 is the InfoNet. InfoNet is typically over by close to 9 p.m. And after that, Bill, KC2QIW, no, Bill's cold, that is all of a sudden. You know who I mean. Bill takes over with Swap and Shop. So in the vicinity of 10 minutes before to 10 minutes after 9 p.m. Monday evening is when Bill will be holding the Swap and Shop. So I wonder if that's the film you were looking for, Joe. KC2QIW, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Roger that. Are they still going to do it tomorrow? Because I think tomorrow is a... like a legal holiday on Martin Luther King's birthday. So I was just wondering if they're going to still do the that Monday night net. Back to you.
I would say yes, definitely yes. These guys that want to sell and buy things, the fact that it's a holiday, that's not going to slow them down. And when it comes to information, no. I think there's a 90% chance, if you want me to make a guess, that the InfoNet and Swap and Shop will take place tomorrow on Martin Luther King's Memorial Day. So I think you'll get your opportunity to sell or buy at that time, Joe. Now, I know that John had a question with reference to cavity filters, and I'll give you a quick rundown of what a cavity filter is. If I started off, assuming I was going to make one for 2 meters, and if I started off with a piece of pipe in the vicinity of 4 inches diameter, copper pipe, 4 inches diameter, and I seal off one end with a flat plate, and from that flat plate grounded end, I put another piece of copper pipe inside, that is, let me pick a number, inch and a quarter in diameter, and it's soldered to the bottom plate that's closing it off. In the center is the copper pipe, the 1 inch and a quarter of copper pipe, and that is coaxially down the 4 inch diameter pipe. And on 2 meters, if I made that whole circuit, I'm not sure of the exact number, but something in the vicinity of 19 inches long, the rod in the center would be a quarter inch long, a quarter wavelength long, and it would have an extremely high Q resonance. By way of another threaded rod, they run down the center of the inch and a quarter pipe, in my example, and that moves a little bit of a plunger at the end. That gives you the fine tuning. But that kind of a circuit, it's about $10 worth of hardware, so to speak, can give you an extremely high Q, like 5,000 band pass filter, band notch filter, whatever you like. And then inside there, you put a couple of coupling loops. And as I said, if you Google the word cavity resonant filter, and you look at some of those beautiful pictures that you'll find on that particular website, there's a particular website you'll find by way of Google. Those pictures will show you various ways of constructing it. And the actual pickup loop itself, let me drop. The actual pickup loop, if the pickup loop itself has another variable capacitor adjusted in series with the pickup loop, you can not only have a beautiful band pass with a fraction of a dB of loss at the desired frequency, 600 kCOA, you can also, with that auxiliary capacitor on the pickup loop, create an extremely sharp null at the undesired frequency, 600 kCOA. So what we're slowly here to doing is constructing a duplexing filter. It's a set of filters that will allow you to transmit and receive simultaneously out of the exact same. And that's what's really required to make a repeater work. And you need something in the vicinity of 120 decibels of rejection of the transmit frequency on the receive in order for the receiver to work correctly. As you can tell easily with some of the experiments you may have done with a handy talkie in the shack with you, you'll soon discover that a strong local signal can stop a receiver from working correctly. So, that's some of the information I think you're looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
My question is, what is more important? I know the length is going to affect the tuning of that internal rod, but what effect does the volumetrics have? Okay, we have a length, 19 inches, whatever it is, 18 and a half inches, but 4-inch diameter versus, say, 3-inch or 2-inch diameter, what will that affect?
And by the way, anything you guys are hearing, whether you're listening to 146.25 or 147.975, if you're hearing the input frequency of this repeater, and you report what signal strength you're hearing to rfi@limog.org, tell us where you were located at the time and what you're hearing. For instance, right now, I'm hearing a signal around S3 on the input on 147.975. So this person is mobile, he's on the Long Island Expressway, he's heading east at this time, and he's trying to jam this particular repeater. So anything you hear, tell us what you hear, when you hear it, where you were located. Let me drop.
I'd like to suggest you go back to 85.
Roger, Dodger. Do you want to pull my thing?
I'm going to stay here for a little while because I wasn't getting through. Every resonator really is a piece of truth. I am going to flip the antenna. It'll take me 30 seconds to rotate it, and we'll try the other input, and then you can kill this one then. So, standby, I'll be back in about 30 seconds. Q2RIW.
All right, Chief.